On this week's show, Strategic Technology with Peyton Kringley from LS Black.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started The Contech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in Contech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's Contech Crew time.
All right, Nathan Wood, new background, new year. How we doing, buddy?
Oh, man. Actually, kind of wishing I was in, I don't know if that's China or Japan, but I hear they're getting a lot of snow out there. So that's my new bucket list. One of these days, we got to figure out how to go skiing in Japan. But I don't know.
Oh,
that's,
we got to go
that's
get
a side thought.
We got to get some Japao, man. Japao is awesome. We have to get there. So I'm with you. We got our man. I am so psyched to sit down with you today, Peyton. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. I'm excited. I've been a long time listener. I would like to say that this podcast in particular was one of the first podcasts that got me introduced into this whole world of construction technology. To be quite frank, I think is the wave I've rode to kind of the position and, you know, where I'm at today. So I just want to give everyone here kudos to influence and inspiring, you know, impressionable people like me and working towards kind of all the things that you guys have talked about in various, you know, conferences and summits and you name it. So, yeah.
Actually an honor for us to get to do it and to get to do it for this long and to hear those kinds of stories. Although, you know, some people will get in trouble probably for bringing too many people into this world. But no. Listen, I'm really excited to sit down. So give everybody a little bit of an idea of your background. Like you said, I mean, what's really cool about this is, you know, I think your propensity for both technology and construction has been an interesting career path. So we want to hear a little bit about you first and then, you know, what you're up to.
Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the Contech Crew. That's right. We're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@thecontechcrew.com to learn more.
Yeah. So I started basically in construction since I was a kid. My family owns a material supply and procurement in the Dakotas, both North and South Dakota. And so I kind of got to see the supply chain side of things, working in the warehouse, kind of understanding just the vendor relationship with various sub and general contractors. I then went to college for business. And as I kind of unfolded the world of construction, knew that that's where I wanted to be, like most when you have an influence in your family that is kind of pushing you into a particular industry. And then in concert of that, I always kind of had a knack for technology and systems. And I really enjoyed that kind of thinking style, I think, since I was a kid. As I went to school, I went for business and then I picked up a construction management, started off in operations as a project engineer and found myself working on processes and process mapping and systems and data flows and kind of maybe unconventional to the typical kind of, I was kind of working on the business as I was in the business. And as I was kind of scaling up from multiple projects, it kind of felt natural for me to transition into what was a business analyst role, which, you know, 4 or 5 years ago was a hot topic. And I was actually in one of Jeff's sessions at a conference, and he was talking about the power of business analysts and kind of where the industry is going. So it was fun to see the kind of correlation to my experience in that world. And then as I then transitioned from a business analyst, it was like, all right, here's another business problem. Here's another business problem. Here's another business problem. Can you build a Power BI dashboard for our financials, for our HR, for our estimating and pre-con? And all of a sudden I was touching every aspect of the business. And what was found was kind of, okay, well, we're going to put him right underneath, you know, what was kind of my predecessing role at the time. You're going to learn the financials and the business, you know, working on the business, capital expenditures, you name it. So my role at a contractor of our size is kind of like a tech-enabled CFO or kind of like a, I'm not a CFO traditionally. I don't have an accounting background, but I've learned more debits and credits than I've ever desired to in my entire life. But that's kind of just with tandem of this kind of next problem, next solution kind of working through my career. It's kind of landed to where I'm at today. And it's given me kind of a really fun and unique role in our executive leadership team to be kind of tech enabled and be that kind of strategic thinker within our business that kind of helps gear us forward at a contractor of our size. So I get to play a lot. I don't have to move the big cruise ship, you know, exactly, but I get kind of good autonomy to do so.
Well, talk a little bit about that. What size? You're at LS Black now. Talk a little bit about the size of the company. What kind of work you guys do?
Yeah, so we're about $150 million GC. We primarily do, I would say, federal Department of Defense work, where we work heavily with the Corps of Engineers. We build a lot of dormitories, Army Reserve centers, dining facilities, kind of infrastructure for various Army, Navy, kind of defense operations, military installations, stuff like that. And then we do a little bit of commercial here locally in the Twin Cities. Twin Cities, we feel, is a really good and competitive place for us to invest and groom and develop people. So we do a lot of stuff for higher education, have kind of local, you know, if we were just kind of a national federal contractor, it makes it difficult to find kind of that middle management training. So we feel that our local presence gives us opportunity to kind of build relationships locally. It's a pretty competitive market here in Minneapolis, but it feels good to be in the center of that and not just kind of be the satellite office for the entire country. And then we've done some self-developed housing as well. So stick frame. So we got kind of a diverse resume to say the least, but federal is kind of our bread and butter.
That's awesome. I mean, I want to dig into this role a little bit more. I mean, I know it's like this undefined kind of jack of all trades, just like go solve this problem. I don't know if you have an official title or not, but I guess having had some sort of a similar role where you just have a really long leash and just all these people asking you to kind of solve their problems, like, how do you prioritize your time? Like, how do you keep that stuff organized when you're just solving problems all over the place? Like, what's your strategy for keeping that stuff organized?
It's pretty tough, especially dropping down to the level of technicality required to maybe solve a problem. And I've talked to Jeff quite a bit about this. Transitioning into more of a leadership role and empowering people to think like you and to be motivated and enthusiastic around some set, like, general principles of thinking versus me solving every single thing that comes up. I've kind of had to learn to transition out of that and try to empower my team and build a team and put people in place to help solve these problems versus, hey, Peyton, here's a big problem. Okay, now I have a backlog of 10 different problems that I'm trying to work through, dropping down to the level of detail that's required from a technical standpoint. But then also, you know, I'm responsible still from like a financial standpoint, reporting, making sure that, you know, our cadence is appropriate and stuff like that. So I will say it requires a little bit of hovering from the 30,000 foot view down into the weeds. And that's not something that should be taken lightly. It's definitely very difficult. But sometimes I love getting my hands dirty and play, you know, like I said, playing and tinkering. And, you know, it's helpful to see how the dots connect. It's also helpful to actually know how it's going to be executed and connected and what have you. So it's tough. I don't think that there's a one size fits all.
But I would say that because I was definitely not under any sort of financial umbrella. I think the fact that you are under the financial, although it seemed like you're such an innovative innovation type role, but I think, yeah, being within that, the guardrails, I guess, of that is probably a smart way to go if you're a company. you have to follow the money at the end of the day, right?
Yeah. And it's, I actually think that the combination that is unique to understanding capital expense, like understanding the idea of deferred liability, like, We use the common term of technical debt, but I see correlations with, you know, deferring a problem to the future while providing an ad hoc solution now. There's a lot of trying to identify what is a interim solution, you know, a quote unquote band-aid, but then also how do you, you know, are you just going to defer this into the future and it just accrues interest? You know, you need to solve that, you know, and how do you prioritize? And I've kind of started to think in terms of what's the magnitude of this particular issue and what's the upside and kind of thinking in those terms. Whereas before I was just kind of like, oh, I know how to solve that. I know how to solve that. I know how to solve that. Now it's like, okay, that's $1 million issue. That's $100,000 issue. That's $5,000 issue. And trying to be able to discern some of that.
It's an incredibly cool path. And this is what's been cool. This is when I say we get the privilege to do this is, you know, I remember you showing up, Peyton, and talking about your role and being really interested in your mindset. Cause it is hard. You are a fixer. Like the thing about you that's really been unique, I think, is you're tech enabled, but you're a problem solver when it comes down to it. And I mean, you've learned parts of the business from the financial side over the last part that most people wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't cross that line. You wouldn't see somebody come from the field, come from a PM role or a PE role, and then make it into the financial world. So it's really unique to have that ability to go back and forth. I'm really interested where, you know, talk about some of your early wins, some of the early things that made you like, wow, these are little problems. And then maybe one of those Band-Aids that eventually, you know, you probably created and had to rip off. So I'd like to hear some of the wins and maybe some of the what that tech debt looked like.
Yeah, I learned pretty quickly with what you build, you have to support. And that idea of, okay, well, am I going to customize this thing and try to dig myself? There's kind of this problem where you don't know if you're digging out of a hole or digging yourself deeper into a hole and the level of support that's required to maintain that. And you learn pretty quickly when you build a solution ad hoc that works, and then all of a sudden 2 weeks later it's down, you got to stop everything you're doing to go and fix it. I learned that pretty quickly, just kind of starting out in like a Microsoft Flow environment, low code, no code. You know, the benefit of that is that it gets your hands on learning how to do certain kind of if-thens and triggers and flows and everything else. But is it really probably the most technically sufficient form of delivering that problem consistently, right? And I kind of learned my limits there, I would say, pretty early with some of the solutions that it just kind of felt like it was like, all right, prop this up. Okay, now indefinite support. And my personality isn't necessarily on the maintain and support side, I'll just be honest. Like, but now knowing that you don't want to build a car that the mechanic has to wrench on indefinitely, it's nice to be the person that has the understanding, okay, well, the mechanic workload is also your fault, so you have to fix both of those. And that, I think, initially is what taught me the difference between, you know, the technical debt versus something that I'm, you know, that is maybe a well thought out centrally planned solution that's not ad hoc. I think though, to start though, you have to tinker, you have to learn, you have to build, you know, break and fix and kind of groom yourself out of, you know, build. And it's the same thing with construction, actually. I mean, you home build and you build something at your house, and all of a sudden it doesn't work, and guess what you're fixing every month that it, you know, that's not working, right? There's kind of a general rule that I kind of use now for when I think about how to solve a solution in that regard. So I would say, you know, from a immediate win, I just kind of initially it was solving problems. And then in the biggest piece, I think that I stood out from most is I kind of looked at the psychology. I kind of felt that construction in particular just had this like resistance to the use of technology. And we had superintendents and foremen and whoever they were, you know, purchasing boats on Craigslist and using their computer like nothing for those purposes. But when it came to work, it was like, hey, can I get you to enter a time card in without any issue? And so then I took like a big deep dive into some of the, like, I was reading papers, literature on technology attitudes. Mm-hmm. And that's where my paper or my article that I wrote that I sent to you, Jeff, initially, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, that kind of came on it was kind of unique and interesting. And what I did is I kind of built a case for practical ways based on these tech profiles, how to kind of bridge the gap per se to empower and build confidence with field staff and employees, kind of from an engagement standpoint. I would say it was like an engagement strategy, you know, using the innovation diffusion model where it's the 16% and crossing the chasm. And I kind of folded that with this paper that talks through the three attitudes towards technology, which are confidence, approval, and wow, I'm drawing a blank on the third one. It's been 4 years. I then did an AGC keynote event that was with Jeff on that particular topic that I felt was, it somewhat hit home for most people, I think. And, you know, it's not like a light switch where people just all of a sudden jump up with technology. But what's really cool is you just start to think passively what technology has been implemented in the last however many years and kind of the transition from that perspective. And then also my role as a kind of a proxy to tech, you know, technology is coming whether we like it or not. I try to go about it where it's not compliance, you have to do this using coercion to, you know, I try to figure out what actually gets people engaged and empowered behind these tools. So I would say that that was probably one of my bigger successes.
So I want to go back to something you said there, because, you know, we talk about the resistance to technology adoption and I think as I was hearing your description, the way I would maybe rephrase, I'm curious your thoughts, is it's maybe less resistance to technology, because again, they can use the phone or the computer, whatever, to go buy something and use it for other things. It's this resistance to tinkering, that word tinkering, that is something that you innately like to do, but they may innately not like to do. They don't like to tinker. They just want you to tell them how to do it.
Right.
And go back even further to something else you said of it's teaching people how to think versus
yes.
how to do. So I guess, like, one, how do you convince someone that just wants you to tell them how to do it? No, I'm trying to convince you, or I'm trying to teach you how to think, because you can't just say that, right? Like, how do you say that? Let's start there. Like, or what is the difference? Yeah, like, help me unpack that.
That's super interesting. So I would say that this is like one of my general guiding philosophies as it relates to just, you know, one of the best parts about working at Ellis Black, our tagline is built to perform, which I think hits home from multiple areas. I think when you take ownership of how the performance of something, you're delivering something that actually has to perform. It's got a spirit. It's got an operational process behind whatever that building is that you're turning over to someone. I think the same way with the tinkering, it's really hard to understand what does or doesn't work when you're not tinkering. If you're just handing something over as a product and it doesn't work, and you don't have to be the person that maintains or supports that said thing, you're not the facility manager having to fix the thing that's costing tons and tons and tons and tons of money, because as soon as you handed it over, it's not your problem. And I don't think that thinking that's very transactional, and it's very how focused. And what you're saying, I think, is maybe one of my, again, guiding critical thinking guidelines is, why are you building this? What are you building it for? And how does it work? And if you're building it, how don't you know how you can make it work that way? Or it's more in the realm of just trying to get people to think about, if you had to operate or support this, and you had the responsibility of supporting it, then why wouldn't you do it right away? And I think what ends up happening is we kind of defer this technical debt downstream, and then someone has to work on the bad car, or the crappy building that's built, or the product that's not very good, or the solution that's not very good. Does that answer your question, or
it's bringing me to another question of, yeah, like, how much time do you spend building something to make it right before giving it to someone to tell them that it's wrong so you can learn? Because again, it's this whole iterative learning, you know, like tinkering is trying to use it not working, and you telling someone it doesn't work, and then them going and doing something about it. And I think we just have such an expectation in our industry that it should just work the first time.
Yes.
But it's not going to, right? Like, that's how you learn. That is the iterative process. And I think that's a little bit like cultural, like, how do you make it comfortable to give someone something that might not be ready for prime time yet? Or,
yep.
or are there only certain people that you give it to? Like, how do you kind of roll out alpha or beta stuff maybe differently as you look down that innovation chasm of the early adopters versus the laggards? Like, do you, like, I guess, either intentionally or unintentionally have strategies around like rolling out new tech with certain types of people or certain projects?
I would say that that's probably this like next challenge I feel like I'm trying to solve at the level of leadership I am, you know, trying to become more of a leader than a doer or even a manager, trying to empower people to feel like, I mean, one of the biggest things I feel like in this tech profiles was confidence. Like, most people feel like they're breaking something, and then like, no, that I want you to break it. That's the point. Like, let's figure this out. Let's give you enough room of grace to fail and work through these problems so that you understand how it is the thing that you're using. I think we have such like a black box society where it's like you pick up the phone, you have no idea how it works. It's just magic. And we just interface with these kind of, you know, black boxes. And it's just not how I am. I'm like, okay, well, this works. Okay, well, why does it work like that? And then I kind of like go a layer below that. And then I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not going any deeper. I'm not trying to be an expert. I just want to understand what it is that you're selling me technically. And that, I think you're right. I think our industry doesn't really have the cultural kind of desire for that, maybe. They kind of think like, hey, this hammer is a tool. But that's another good point, though, is there's a ton of equipment that's out there that I would consider as a form of technology that they have no problem asking what's under the hood or how does it work. But in the same regard, it's like that phone is it not even like in the same domain, which in my head generally is the same.
you hit on something there, is that the definition of technology is what's broken. And it creates a barrier just in like watching your career and watching you grow through this and seeing you over years bring your leadership there, grow into leadership. You never took those wrong titles and put the wall up of innovation and technology is separate from the business.
Yes.
You, I think, look at all the things as though they're built to perform, and you have an empathy for how they're going to perform. I think that's probably where you've earned more stripes than anywhere with folks, is the ability to build a few things, band-aid some things, have to fix them, turn to those same people who I think probably still work there and go, yeah, that was a band-aid, that didn't work. We're gonna need to upgrade. And they saw you upgrade and realize that, like, oh, he can improve and he's making this thing now approachable for all of us. And you're diving into the numbers and the accounting, you're diving into the business process and the construction process and having an empathy for how it's going to work. And that's what I think we need to teach. We've created a barrier between us in calling technology technology. If we called something new on it, I mean, you go look at any of the new heavy equipment, you're stepping into a computer.
Yeah. I mean, it's technology. I mean, I went so far as to like kind of organize our chart of like from a financial standpoint for us to kind of think of technology in relation to small tools. Like, as a project manager, how are you supposed to do your job without your tool set? Like, it's related to your operational workflow. So I feel like what ends up happening is the performance or the actual output of the service that you're selling is not at all related to the solutions that are the tools that you're using. And so I'm trying to, from a macro standpoint, shift our thinking there too, which is, most companies, what they'll do is they'll put like a basis points on the total revenue, and they don't correlate it at all with the hours worked, or especially on lump sum projects. But I'm trying to get us to start to think in alignment of, okay, this is a service that this project manager is providing, and this is their tool belt. Like, this is everything that's related to the service that they're providing that is empowering them to do their jobs. It'd be like sending a foreman out there without a hammer and saying, well, we're not going to charge the owner a hammer, because why would we do that? But if we did that, nothing would get built. And that's kind of I'm trying to shift our thinking a little bit.
I like that. It's like your PPE is part of your tech stack. Because at the end of the day, like, there's enough of it that is part of your tech stack, and it's part of your HR, because your PPE is your badge. That is how you got access to the site, that knew how long you were on the site and where you were and what tools you picked up and how long you used them. And yeah, it's all tech. It, just like everything is safety, right? Like, you could argue it touches everything, but yet they still live in their own world. And that's, again, not that I know anything about graph architecture and everything, but I feel like that's what's next, right? Is like this, what is the relationship between finance and field and HR and BIM and all these different things, and to plug those things together, right? And that's why we need to think more than we need to know how to do.
That's 100% spot on. I think, one of the things, I mean, understanding my technology budget and kind of being limited to a certain percent to whatever. And I'm like, well, I don't have any of these expenses if we don't have any of these people providing these services. So what is the client actually buying here? I mean, it's a cost of goods sold, which is the services that we're providing, which is your project management software. It's your resource management. I mean, these are all things that are services that are sold to the client indirectly. But in some businesses, that's overhead. That's IT. That's not, I always said, construction benefits from being in the business and not so much on the business. And I'm trying to position, our tech stack and those tools to be more correlated to the actual services that people are providing our clients.
Yeah, I this is what I really like. And this is where I think, when Peyton and I were talking and trying to get him to come on here, one of the things I think that you're really close to, and you're that future leadership, and this is what we need, is you're, Nathan, you kind of just said it without realizing it, but like, well, BIM, well, finance, well, pre-con, we're looking at all of these as separate entities, and they're not. They are a set of services that deliver projects. And currently, this is what they look like, but eventually they will look completely different. And there is this mentality, like you said, Peyton, that like, what if we sent them out and we're like, well, this client, you get a crappy hammer, that's what you get. And we're like, why would we ever do that? We wouldn't do that with our tools, but we seem to believe that we can do that with certain services, certain ways that we're building our businesses. And we have to stop thinking that way and start thinking them as, you know, integrated. I mean, I know, you know, we weren't talking much titles, but VP of strategic, your title is actually really important to me. It's VP of corporate strategy. That's a really important component to how your business can maintain its strategic advantage. It's looking at the tools. It's looking at everything a little differently. So I'm interested in what you're thinking about for the future and how, you know, this might change. I mean, people listening in should be, you know, taking note, and you're a $150 million contractor, but you're operating at a much higher level.
I come from kind of such a, like a pragmatic or practical stance, and it's the same fundam. And I said this at the AGC summit or the AGC conference, you know, we had a big session on AI, and to me, it's the same conversation we had at about data analytics and the preparation for data analytics and getting a data warehouse and getting your integrations and IPaaS and some of these fundamental things that people want to jump to the sexy tool, but don't want to do the fundamental architecture to provide them that, you know, positioning wise for that. And you kind of hit the nail on the head with the way that our business units are basically grouped today may not be how it is in the future. And I think one of the benefits of me being kind of a little bit younger is I look at things from such a fresh first principles perspective. And I'm like, well, that is just this. Like, what is, you know, and I think maybe some solutions like on design phase management or pre-construction or value engineering, it's like, aren't they kind of all the same thing? I mean, and then we have all these titles and positions and all this redundancy and all these large companies. And I'm asking myself, well, is this just a big redundant thing? And then it's all standing on the shoulders of these systems or solutions, and those don't get the credit for those services. So I think what's next for me is just like sticking to some fundamental things where, I mean, we're trying to position ourselves from an AI standpoint, understanding our integrations and our data warehousing and making sure point of entry, something simple as our HR tool or HRIS, making sure that at the point of onboarding or at the point of application, that is when you collect all of your employees' resume information. You shouldn't, and then that information should pool right into your CRM. And you shouldn't have to gather what people are, what have they worked on, what school they went to, you name it. What's their certification? What's the various trainings that they've done? Are they OSHA 30? Are they willing to travel? Like all that information, and it's just as a practical example of something that we're working on, that should all just come straight off of our onboarding process and our application and recruiting process. Whereas there's so much redundancy of having administrators or coordinators grab that information, build out resumes. I honestly think that a lot of the work that we're doing is just pushing information back and forth. That's just unnecessary. So that's like a fundamental thing that I'm trying to solve. And then AI is just sweet sauce on top of all of that. You know, making sure all that information's accurate, connected, the source of truth is there. I think the problem with like an AI is that it's coming so fast that you gotta almost take strides and move towards something. And you have like tools like Trunk Tools or Rethink or other items, you know, project operational softwares. But I think I'm just trying to get people empowered to think about problems differently versus try to say, hey, we need to grab this shiny object off the shelf and throw it at our business. That's just not, I just have never found a lot of success with that style of work, of operation. It's what is the problem we're solving, not here's a solution looking for a problem, if that makes sense.
I think you're absolutely right, Peyton, when you talk about the shiny tools and not chasing them, because I talk about this a lot. Like, I do believe AI is going to have a big impact, right? I don't think we're even close to understanding what that impact's going to be. I'm on record saying a few things. I don't believe it's ready completely. I think a lot of those solutions are going to leave people wanting more. And it's going to be based on the fact that they didn't get their blocking and tackling done. What you're talking about on onboarding people, we've been talking about for 10 years in this industry since I've been here, and they still don't have it nailed. Large contractors across this country have entire departments that spend their lives calling people and putting those things together as they bid out jobs. and we talk about having a labor issue. No, we have a flow issue. We have a, they talk about a productivity issue. Our productivity issue isn't in the field necessarily. It's in our offices. It's in our data. It's in those areas. AI is the really nice icing, but you have to build a cake first, or you're just eating icing and that's not going to go very well, right? It's a very important process for you to build from ground up and to think that way. Also, you know, you think you have empathy for the mechanic. You're having empathy for your employee, because having to have that employee toss you that information all the time, it's like having a conversation with somebody and not remembering anything they said.
Exactly.
It's really not, it's just poor form.
That's exactly the point I was trying to make. You're thinking about the mechanic, because I've lived it. You know, if you're fixing what you built, then you know exactly, you feel empathy. You're like, oh, that's my fault. I did that. I think that we need to start thinking about problems differently, more so than, you know, and I think this is one of the things that a lot of different industries do. And I think we generally have to steal guiding principles from other industries like lean and all these other kind of forms or methodologies. And I just think fundamentally, you think from a first principle standpoint and you just look at the problems, you know, individually. And if you have the breadth or the understanding of your business and the resources, then you can deploy solutions for them. I'm excited about AI. I think it's super awesome, and I'm excited for the world of solutions. But, you know, I think we think of AI replacing the jobs we have today versus the systems that should just have replaced those, like you said. Like, we have entire departments dedicated to these functions of work, administrators, coordinators, you name it, that are not, we don't think of the services that they're providing as the equivalent of the solution that we just purchased. It's almost like they're two separate things. Well, and so
it's the Band-Aid. The Band-Aid's continuing to grow. We do it in business as much as we do it in tech. It's the same thing. We were Band-Aiding a problem that truly existed. Like, to anybody listening that's like, well, hey, are you saying my job's not valuable? No, your job was valuable at a point in time. But now that process is not valuable anymore. And we need to update it and upgrade it and move it forward and do things differently. And that's, again, kind of where I'm really impressed with what you guys are doing at LS Black, because to keep you in a position of leadership and engaged, but working on the company, not in the company, that is creating such a huge advantage and such an ability to continue to innovate and change. I think it's why you're being so successful and the company's being so successful, because you're actually keeping those things separate right now.
Yeah. And I know we got to close out, but it just to echo what Jeff and what you said earlier, I mean, the value of these conversations right here. I mean, Penn, I've learned so much from you and from this conversation. A couple of things I wrote down before we close out here is, you know, I think there's a difference between what you said, empathy, and another thing, which is responsibility. Like, empathy is like feeling for someone else. The fact that they were pissed off because of something that you built, that's like now you feeling responsibility for that. And that's a very different thing than empathy. It kind of, they coincide. But I think maybe like the strategy moving forward, I'm curious if you agree or disagree or have other thoughts, but I think to date, the way that software has handled this industry, the way that Contech tries to solve our problems, is they follow a process, they follow a problem, and they're looking for data around or ways they can collect it in a way that they can solve it. And really, as what you were, I think, describing earlier is, no, if we actually have that measurement, if we have that data, if we know what we care about before we even start talking about the process and build a process around the data that matters and then allow software to build stuff around that, like, that to me is like the most organic, creative, you know, thinking before we do way of solving it, you know, easier said than done. But yeah, it's like, maybe if we can just do that, right?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I think I, at one point, thought that if I, in a room, mapped this entire thing out by myself, and I created the secret sauce and the most theoretical solution and problem that this solves, I just found myself falling flat because I'm not getting the individual stressors required. And so I'm building this robust system, but I'm not building something that adapts to the future. And there's a book called Anti-Fragile that's around this topic, but you need, from a tinkering standpoint, you can't really truly innovate something that's going to last through time without those tinkering stressors. You can't get that practical input. You can't just come out with a solution and think, okay, this is going to solve all of my problems, X, Y, and Z. And then 3 years later, something upstream happens and you don't have that. So you're not in the environment of stress that helps benefit how the solution adapts. It's a fine line there, though, because you don't want to be so ad hoc. You're just building the next thing. So,
well said.
Yeah.
We're gonna leave it with that one, man. That was awesome. That was perfect. It's awesome to sit down with you, Peyton. It's been a long time coming, and I'm excited that you got to sit down with us and come on the show.
Thanks.
Nathan, thanks as always for sitting down with me and having another interesting conversation, right?
And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Peyton Kringley. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is The Content Crew, signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.